Hello and welcome to Hacker Voice Radio. You are listening to us on the 12th of May 2006, and it's a special bonanza show because we've got Robert Schifrin. I hope I correctly pronounced your last name there.
Yeah, that's fine.
How's it going?
Very good, thank you. Thank you for inviting me on.
No problems. It's a pleasure to have you on Hacker Voice Radio. We've got Dark Nature as well here co-hosting today's interview.
Hi, how's it going?
Not bad. So are you enjoying the summer, Robert?
Absolutely, yes. Rather nice. It's been sort of about 22, 23 degrees here today, so I've been walking along the beach and just having a good time and trying not to do too much work.
Yeah, sadly, I've been plagued by server issues today, so I've spent most of the day indoors in an office in a server room rather than, you know, enjoying the sun. But sadly,
I don't run any servers myself. I let other people look after those, so thankfully I haven't got to worry about it. And the ones I do use, the ones I do run myself, they're just sort of for testing and stuff, so if they break, they break. It's not a huge problem, and certainly not a problem enough to go and fix during the nice summer.
Well, you're lucky. We're still
told you the half live, eh?
Yeah. So just to kind of give everybody a basic introduction to who you are,
mm-hmm.
and what you've been up to in the past in the 80s and what you're really up to now. You were the first person to be trialed by jury with connection to computer misuse or computer hacking, and ultimately resulted in the Computer Misuse Act 1990, which outlawed the practice. And now you've released a few books. You were in Falls Bookstore signing away books. I think you met up with Reverend Rat of 2600 Meetings, and various other people.
Right. Yeah, I was mostly into hacking about more than 20 years ago, before it was illegal in the UK. Never made any secret of what I was doing, just sort of went around trying to guess people's passwords, trying to stumble across mistakes people had made and exploit them. I wasn't, you know, a desperately clever hacker. People seemed to think I was quite clever at getting into systems. And really, I just exploited mistakes that people made.
Yeah.
I was using a BT system, a British Telecom system called Prestel, which was like a dial-up version of CFAX, if you like, very much a precursor to the internet. And I was a paid-up user of the system, and one day I was testing a modem on my computer, just tapped in some random keys, and happened to stumble across a valid username and password.
Right.
And this username and password belonged to a member of the Prestel staff. Because of who he was allowed to look at various closed areas of the system, including a list of phone numbers for their test computers.
Ah.
And being at that point I thought, well, this could be quite interesting, you know, maybe I could be a hacker after all. So I dialed up these test computers and it said, you know, good afternoon, welcome to the Prestel test computer, please log in. And I couldn't get any further than that. But by that point, I'd sort of become a bit obsessive, and I thought, well, I'll keep trying, you never know. And I tried for about a period of 10 months to get into this test computer. And one day in, I think, November it was, 1984 or so, and I dialed up the test computer, and it said, hello, welcome to the Prestel test computer, please log in. And then underneath that, somebody had written the system manager password on the please log in screen, because it was only a test computer, and the programmers thought, well, you know, we want the system manager password to be handy. What's even easier to write on than a post-it note? I know, we'll put it on the login screen, which is what they did. And they thought, well, it's quite safe because no one's got the phone number of this computer. This is before the days when every machine had an IP address. So there it was in front of me with a system manager password. So I typed it in, and it said, hello, welcome to the system, you know, system manager, what do you want to do? So I thought, okay, well, since I'm system manager, I'll look up people's accounts. And the system manager on Prestel was allowed to do that. And I could look at anybody's password, I could look at their account details, I could look at their addresses and all that sort of stuff. And that's really how I got into it. Little did I know that I was being watched Basically, because I went to Prestel a few days later and said, you know, look what I've done, and I anonymously said to them, you know, let me help you try and fix the loopholes. And rather than cooperating with me, they called in the police. I was arrested, and luckily for me, there was no Computer Misuse Act.
Yeah.
Which you know, nowadays it's different in the UK. Nowadays we have the Computer Misuse Act. There was nothing then. This was pre 1990. So the police suggested that they charge me with forgery. The idea being, they said that typing in a password was going to be like forging a signature.
Sure.
And the whole thing went through the law courts. It went all the way to the House of Lords, which is the Supreme Court in the UK. Cost about £2 million in legal aid, which luckily I didn't have to pay. Involved about 10 different judges, and took an awful long time. And eventually, I was let off. I was acquitted. And the House of Lords said that, yes, computer hacking should be illegal, but forgery isn't what we should use to cover it. So Parliament went and made a Computer Misuse Act. I got off, and computer hackers nowadays are breaking the law, but when I was doing it, I wasn't.
Right.
And that was an interesting sort of couple of years of my life.
I'm sure it was. So really, what was going through your mind when you were...
I was enjoying myself trying... maybe a sort of as an intellectual exercise to just try and break into as many systems as I could, find out as many passwords as I could, purely for my own entertainment. I had my little blue book, as all hackers do, and when I discovered someone's password, I wrote it in my book. Unfortunately, it all got a little bit too easy, because once I was system manager of Prestel, I could just look up anybody's username and password. The system worked like that. It shouldn't have done. You know, one of the things that hackers and security consultants, be they black hats and white hats, say nowadays is, you know, don't have a system whereby the system manager can look up someone's password. But that's the way it worked then, so I could look up any one of the passwords of the 50,000 subscribers, one of whom was Prince Philip. So I looked up his password, and that's how I got my name in all the papers.
Yeah.
And I didn't really worry about it being illegal. Yeah. I suppose it didn't really cross my mind.
So you didn't think that all your dial-up sessions weren't being tracked or anything like that? That didn't really go through your mind. Were you doing this from your house, or...?
I was doing it from my house on old micros, such as a BBC Micro and a Sinclair Spectrum in the early days, but it didn't really matter, because all I was doing was using those as a keyboard to a remote system via a modem. And, yes, I was doing it from home via dial-up, and ultimately, once the police were on to me, it turned out that they were indeed monitoring all the phone calls I made, both to my co-defendant and to all the computers I dialed up. And once they then had their suspicions that I was hacking into lots of systems, they then installed a data monitor on my line, which recorded all the information that went down it. And one of the things they produced in court for the jury were printouts showing the sort of things I was doing and all the screens I was looking at. I never argued that I hadn't been hacking.
Sure.
I never denied, you know, hacking the systems. What I denied, and what my lawyers denied on my behalf, was that hacking was illegal. And that's what, basically, we spent 3 years arguing about the meaning of two words in the Forgery Act. And, I mean, just to go into technical details very briefly, when you forge someone's signature or forge, you know, a coin or a note, you physically make something, and that's a real thing that exists for a long time. When you forge, or so they say, a password, what they were saying is that I typed in somebody else's password, that was stored in the computer for a millisecond while it was checked to see if it was valid. And what the prosecution tried to say is that while that password I typed in was sat in the computer for a millisecond to be checked, that's the same as forging a banknote or a signature. And you might say, well, that's an easy thing. Is it, you know, is it yes or no? And it took 2 years, and it took £2 million to basically decide that. It was an important test case, because it would have had important repercussions either way.
Yeah.
It certainly did.
Do you have any questions, Dark Ninja? I'm totally talking over you. Go ahead, Dark Ninja.
Yeah, I just listening quietly there. Did it possibly occur to you since the act of leaving the system manager's password on the login screen might have been, in light of the fact that the police were on to you all the time and monitoring your phone calls, could it have been one of the first ever honeypots?
No, it wasn't a honeypot. That sort of thing hadn't really been thought of. And BT happily admitted in court that the reason the password was on the login screen is because the programmers basically had made a mistake. Nowadays, you know, the press would say, well, in that case, they semi-deserved everything they got. But in those days, they didn't. And, you know, the jury didn't consider that. But it was mentioned in court that BT had been a bit stupid. And they basically agreed that, yes, that might be the case.
Yeah. So if that password wasn't on the screen, it wouldn't have been so much of a temptation for you to access it. Because obviously, from your point of view, you had the admin password, you had root in front of you, so why not go in?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't technical enough and knowledgeable enough to have tried to break into the system and get root in any other way, but when somebody sticks the root password on the login screen, anybody with a bit of curiosity is going to try it. And, you know, I was now root on this big mainframe computer that was supporting, you know, thousands of users. And I was simply, you know, looking around it for my own entertainment and my own knowledge. And it's quite a good feeling. One of the things that people say to me is, did you carry on hacking? You know, do you hack now? And having got up to root on a decent mainframe computer, I sort of gave up hacking because there's not much further you can go after that. Also, you talked about honeypots and were the police and BT trying to attract hackers. I think it's important to realise that 20 years ago when I was doing this, even more than 20 years ago, people didn't really use computers enormously. Yes, some companies had computer networks, but they didn't quite know what for.
Sure.
No, but, you know, all the corporate information, all the important stuff was stored on bits of paper. Email hadn't really been invented. All the databases and stuff were in big books stored in filing cabinets in the basement. If I hacked into someone's system and broke their network and they couldn't use their computer for a week, they probably wouldn't even care. They probably wouldn't even notice.
Sure.
So there was no real need to start catching computer criminals because they weren't really posing a threat.
Yeah.
Obviously, that's completely different nowadays.
So,
well, perhaps Honeypot was... Oh, sorry.
Sorry, go ahead, Dr. Ninja.
I'm on a delay again. Perhaps honeypot was the wrong word to use. But what I really meant was, in light of the fact that they knew you were onto something.
I take your point, but I see what you mean, because I did spend, you know, 10 months logging into this test computer and dialing it up. It's possible that they planted that there for my benefit, but it was never mentioned, and they never suggested that that was the case. If it had been the case, and they were knowing what they were doing, they would have planted it there, and they would have put some dummy data behind it, such that if I did log in as root on this test computer, I wouldn't. Yes, they could catch me doing it, but they wouldn't. That I wouldn't find any particularly confidential information. Mm. As it happened, I did, for the simple reason that this test computer contained live data. So once I'd looked up the passwords for various people on the test computer, because there was a complete copy of the live database on there, I could look up the password for any real user and then switch across to the live computers, the real ones, and look up their information there. So anybody, you know, who knows what they're doing and was sufficiently knowledgeable and interested in security to set up a sort of trap in some way wouldn't have put real live confidential data behind it. That's not the way you do honeypots. It certainly isn't now, and I guess it wasn't then.
Just a question from our IRC channel, from Enigma. Was the system with the password that was on screen a publicly known system, or was it basically behind their, as it were, behind their secret systems?
It was. The only way it was protected was the fact that it was it was on the end of a phone number that only BT staff knew.
Right. So
and the reason I knew the phone number is because I'd stumbled across this other test account on the live system when I was testing a modem.
Okay.
I was testing this modem. I stumbled across, this was on the public system, stumbled across a username that consisted of 10 twos and a password of 1234. That then got me into a closed part of Prestel, which contained all the phone numbers of the test computers. And then all I did was dial up the phone numbers, and on one of those phone numbers I found the system manager ID.
Right.
So it wasn't behind a firewall or anything like that. It was simply behind a phone number that they thought nobody knew.
Hmm.
But what they didn't realise is that a few months earlier, I had found that phone number through another mistake that they'd made.
Right. So it was security through obscurity then?
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
They just thought, well, it's quite safe to leave the system manager root password on this thing because no one's got the phone number.
Yeah.
But even not only did I have it, but any member of the Prestel staff could have seen that phone number. So basically a lot of people could have got in there and gone as root on the test computer, which would have, and because there was a copy of the live database from the live computers on the test computer, once you were system manager of the test computer, you could look up real information.
Yeah. So were you aware of any other hackers or any other group of, like a community at that time? Were you?
There was a small group of London hackers. Obviously, all of them were friends of mine. Some of them I still keep in contact with. Most of them I don't. Some of them are off doing clever things like writing Hollywood film scripts and whatever and doing very well for themselves. There were six or seven of us. You might think that the only way we ever met was to talk on, bulletin boards and chat rooms and stuff. Actually, that wasn't the case. We did often meet in person at each other's houses.
Right.
And every month or two, we all met round a table in London and in a Chinese restaurant and ate lots of food and swapped passwords. So we all sort of lived vaguely near each other in North London.
Right.
And we were a small group of, six or seven people.
Right. So it was like a pre-2600 kind of meeting.
I guess it was, We used to swap passwords and swap phone numbers for various systems we'd discovered.
Mm.
Because, back before the internet, which this mostly, this entirely was, you had three bits of information you had to find to get into a computer. You had the username and password, but also you had the phone number. And nowadays, with the internet, you don't have that. But in my day, every computer had its own phone numbers. The first thing you had to do was to find out what they were, hence the war dialers.
Yeah. That was,
and, of course, that also means that hackers didn't use, certainly in the UK, telephone calls during the morning were very expensive.
Mm.
During the afternoon and the early evening, they were quite expensive, and they only got cheap after 6 p.m. So most hackers didn't actually start hacking until 6 p.m. And hackers in the UK rarely tried getting into US systems because the phone calls were much more expensive. Nowadays, with the internet, of course, we can hack anywhere in the world for a fixed monthly fee.
Mm-hmm.
And that, that is great news for the hackers, but it has really changed the way that security staff have to protect their systems because they're now open to attack on a much wider window.
Sure. So were you aware of any kind of freaking going on with, like, blue boxing or anything like that back in the day?
A couple of people that I was involved with on the hacking side had been into freaking previously, but it's not something I ever did. And it's not something that was going on when I was hacking, at least not as far as I knew. Obviously, there were freaking things going on. I did read about it occasionally in some files that used to go around on bulletin board systems about them.
Yeah.
But it wasn't something I was into or any of the people that I used to know.
Right. So kind of moving on forward in time to round about today, I'm sure you're aware of the things that are happening now with Gary McKinnon and his extradition case, and obviously the changes in privacy and personal information and all that kind of stuff. Kind of looking from two aspects here, obviously your case was completely different compared to Gary's case. But how do you see what Gary was doing, in a sense, non-malicious information gathering, is similar to yourself, whereby you stumble upon, you get lucky, pretty much what Gary was doing for a long period of time. How do you see, you know, what are your thoughts on his case? Do you think he should be extradited? Do you think he should go to 70 years in jail, or do you think he should have a shorter sentence, or get scot-free? Or
it's a very difficult situation and a very difficult thing to comment on. There's a lot of similarities between mine and Gary's case. We were both hacking into various systems, not with the intention of causing damage, but just with the intention of highlighting weaknesses in systems. The big difference is that when I was doing it, it wasn't illegal, and I was pretty sure that was the case.
Sorry about that.
When Gary was doing it, obviously it was illegal, and I guess he knew that.
Yeah.
His timing wasn't ideal either, because he was hacking into US military systems in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks.
Exactly, yeah.
Having said that, the actual damage he did, you know, one could argue wasn't huge. Yes, the US are saying it cost $300,000 to put right, but it's very difficult to say how much it cost, because they've obviously got security staff on hand all the time.
Yeah.
And if those security staff weren't putting those things right, they'd either have been doing something else or sitting reading a book. So it didn't actually cost real money to put the systems right.
Hmm.
And even if it did cost $370,000 to put right, that's, you know, what, about 2 minutes expenditure in the US Department of Defense? It's not exactly a lot of money.
Sure.
So it's difficult. Having said that, it's, you know, it's a very difficult case. We do have legislation in this country that adequately covers computer misuse, and I don't quite see why we can't use that to prosecute Gary, and why we have to hand him over to the Americans. I think he should be prosecuted here.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean... go ahead, sorry.
I was going to say, certainly to me, it seems that his crime was committed in the UK. As a UK citizen, the largest part of the damage seems to be in terms of public relations, or public image for the US Department of Defense.
Yes, that's certainly true. Yeah. People don't like, I mean, one of the big problems when companies get hacked into is they dare to go public about the fact they've been hacked into. If a bank system or a high profile system gets broken into, the police have had problems in the past that banks don't report their hacks, because once the situation becomes public, investors will lose confidence in the bank, customers will move their money elsewhere, and so on. And the publicity, the bad publicity, will cost an awful lot more than it would cost, you know, to put the technical problems right. Defense systems get broken into, people get very embarrassed, and you can quite understand why they want to prosecute. And that is probably the problem, especially as... from the few bits of information that have come out so far, you know, Gary has said that a lot of the systems just didn't have any passwords on them. They were using, you know, Windows desktop with remote access software running that didn't have any passwords on them. And if that's the case, you could say that, you know, the people whose systems were broken into are just as guilty as Gary, but it doesn't work like that. In some countries, it does. In some countries, in Europe, I think, the computer misuse legislation says that if you don't protect your systems properly, then you can't prosecute the hackers if they break into them, which I think is a great idea.
Exactly.
But it's not the case in the UK or the US, sadly.
So there's been a number of changes to the Computer Misuse Act since it was made, after your arrest and trial. One of these changes is the change to the regulations of use of tools as far as computer hacking is concerned. These tools aren't specified, but they can be anything from Nmap to exploits that can be actively downloaded from Metasploit, etc. I mean, how do you see the use of Nmap to be necessarily illegal?
The Computer Misuse Act, I think, has gone through a couple of changes. There were some very early problems with it. For example, there was a worry at one point in large companies that if they ran virus scanners on their incoming mail servers, that they were breaking the law, because they were tampering with their staff's email, before it reached them. And in theory, that was against the Computer Misuse Act.
Yeah.
There was also the situation where IT security staff within companies, if they were monitoring someone's computer because they thought they were misusing it, and they came across some child porn, or some other illegal activity, then again, the security staff were breaking the law for seeing this stuff. So
sure.
There's been some clarifications and some amendments that makes it clear that if you're investigating computer misuse, you're entitled to come across this sort of material without being prosecuted. There is a move now to outlaw the use of hacking tools and outlaw the distribution of them, even outlaw publishing the URLs to them, and the ownership of them. That's not currently law, but the government is hoping it will be.
Yeah.
And although it will make the hacker's job harder, it will also make, you know, white hat people's job harder, and security consultants and pen testers and so on.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's going to be illegal to have a copy of NNAP or even to know where it's stored. And that, I think that's a very bad situation.
Yeah.
The government doesn't realise just how important these tools are. Not, you know, yes, okay to the hackers, but also to the law enforcement community, to security consultants and so on. And only by, you know, if I'm trying to educate companies and explain how to keep hackers out their system, then I've got to tell them these tools exist, and I've got to say, you know, go and get these tools and use them before the hackers do. And I won't be able to do that, and that's going to cause big problems.
It is a bit ridiculous, isn't it? Because
it's totally ridiculous.
Because if you think about it, the hackers are still going to use them.
Of course they are. And it's just another case of, you know, politicians not quite understanding the situation, wanting to be seen to do something, and they don't quite know what they're doing, and possibly taking advice from people who either don't know what they're doing or have got a vested interest in this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But in the end, hopefully common sense will win through, as I said at a seminar I was speaking at InfoSec the other week, where Gary was on the panel as well, and we all agreed that it's just complete madness to outlaw these tools because they are very useful.
It also seems that not only is it lacking common sense, but it would also be more than a little bit unenforceable in terms of definition of hacker tools.
Absolutely. I mean, it's very strange. I mean, if I lock myself out of my house, I can phone a locksmith and he will come round with a special little tool which he pokes in my lock and it will unlock my door. These tools, you know, are freely available to qualified locksmiths, and it's not illegal for them to possess them. Certainly if anybody who wasn't a locksmith was caught with them, people would ask questions as to why they got it, and that's fair enough. And if they had a valid excuse, then okay. To simply say that nobody can use them is completely pointless. And as you say, it's going to be very difficult to enforce. You know, if somebody emails me a list of URLs where I can download NMAP from, am I going to be guilty simply because I've got this list of URLs in my mailbox?
Well, I would confess that it's more than a little difficult to enforce. I would say it's probably impossible to enforce in that it's almost impossible to define what a hacking tool is. For example, I've been having some trouble with my VoIP software, and to help me get around some of the problems, I've been running Etherreel and monitoring the traffic.
Yeah.
I would assume that they would count Etherreel as a hacking tool, just as NMAP, which I think is just madness.
Yeah.
Equally, you know, if I've got some encrypted information on my PC and I export the encryption keys somewhere for safekeeping, is it illegal to possess those recovery keys? If I give them to somebody else for safekeeping, is it illegal for them to possess that? Because in theory, that would give them a backdoor into my data.
Sure. And also correct me if I'm wrong, but the original act didn't actually specify what a computer was. So if your friend reprogrammed your VCR, he was in fact breaking the Computer Misuse Act.
Yes, that's true. If he did it with the intention of doing that and without your permission, then that is the case.
Yeah.
Having said that, it's quite a good idea not to define what a computer is,
right?
Because the trouble with technology is it moves so fast.
Sure.
We have PDAs, we have a USB stick now, with, you know, pen drives and things, and they would count as computers, possibly, under the Computer Misuse Act, and that's probably a good idea, because it means anybody who steals or corrupts or damages those it's the same as breaking into any other system. And because technology moves so fast, it's best not to define what a computer is. Certainly, if you look at it from the sort of law enforcement anti-hacker side.
Yeah, I know. I completely understand. It would make sense if they didn't, you know, say, you know, something with a CPU, RAM, and hard disk, and hopefully a motherboard, is a computer, but generalized it as anything that would contain data. But
a smartphone hasn't got a hard disk.
Sure.
Probably haven't got what you could call a motherboard.
Sure.
So. You know, it's very difficult.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you really think that law would actually go through the change in the tools and everything?
Do I think which law will go through?
The change for the Computer Mystics Act with the addition of the tools.
I think it will probably go through. I think it might well be amended slightly, and hopefully, you know, some of the things will be clarified. But I don't think it will go through exactly as it is. It remains to be seen. I'm not sure what the current situation is with the legislation. I'm not boring enough to follow Parliament in close detail. But I don't think it will go through like it is. I hope not, anyway.
Yeah. It would make people's lives much easier, and probably the whole penetration testing the sector would get a really big jolt, because it would make every single penetration tester's laptop and illegal, because they contain all sorts of tools that can be used for legitimate purposes as well as legitimate purposes.
Indeed, and let's face it, you know, the police don't have the manpower to go after every single person who just tries the odd occasional password or downloads Nmap or whatever.
Yeah.
They only go after the big-scale hackers, the child porn merchants, the terrorists, and so on. And those sort of people are covered by the existing legislation. So making every little inquisitive schoolboy potentially a lawbreaker is just not going to do any good at all.
Sure.
Because, you know, they're not going to go after those people anyway.
No,
so
definitely.
Really, it strikes me that the outcomes of your acts are what you should be charged for. In that it's illegal to murder someone, because at the end of it they're dead. But it's not illegal to own kitchen equipment and know how to use it.
That's certainly true. It's one of the things we were talking about at the conference recently. Why do we need special computer misuse legislation when at the end of the day we don't have any knife misuse legislation? We don't have any gun misuse legislation. At the end of the day, if you use a gun to kill somebody, if you use a knife to stab somebody, you know, it's not illegal to own a ball of string. It is illegal to tie the string around somebody's neck until they're dead. And a lot of computer crime isn't necessarily anything to do with computers, and a lot of crime nowadays just happens to use computers, but it's not classed as computer crime.
Sure.
If somebody robs a bank and they happen to use a computer to plan their escape route, that's not computer crime. So it's all a very complex situation, and it's not necessarily the computer misuse legislation that we should be thinking about. As you say, we should just be thinking about what the end result of the action is, and if it causes damage to someone's system, then it's illegal, regardless of what they used to perpetrate that damage. The trouble is the law doesn't work like that, and the law has to carry on working like it does, because there's an awful lot of highly paid people that need to keep earning their big salaries, not to mention all the MPs that need to keep in work. And if we made the law a little bit more sensible, there'd be a lot of people out of work.
Yeah, we don't want to do that, do we?
it's not for us to say, but the people who make the decisions clearly don't.
Yeah. So, I mean, talking about some of the questions that were put through in our forums, how do you see the open source software community in the computer security area, and whether or not it's a good or bad thing as far as computer security goes to have open source software over closed source software?
I think the open source movement in general is a wonderful thing. Certainly, if you look at Apache versus IIS, the open source movement is the winner in the web server market, even in the corporate world.
Yeah.
The same with web development things like PHP, which has gone up about 10% in the last year or two, whereas Microsoft ASP has shrunk by about 10% in the last year or two.
Hmm.
And we're seeing, you know, some open source security tools and products as well. And I think that's great because partly it's developed by people who are developing the software for their own good and for the good of everybody and not just to make money.
Yeah.
Also, the support is generally better. There are lots of people developing add-ins for it, and it's a community effort. And, you only have to look at a Microsoft press release nowadays where they go about rubbishing Linux and how the total cost of ownership of Windows is actually less than Linux. You know, to have a company the size of Microsoft worried and to have a company the size of Microsoft losing out in a couple of key, hugely important strategic areas like web servers to open source software is going to be very worrying for them. It just goes to show how successful open source is, and long may it continue. Mm-hmm. I'm into Apache, I'm into PHP, I don't touch Microsoft web server technology. Most of the people I deal with don't either, and I think that's great.
Yeah. So I know it's a bit of a personal question, but what do you run at home and on your laptops, etc.?
I use Windows. I work a couple of days a week for a university, which gives me access to free copies of Windows XP, so I run Windows at home, partly because I've spent 20 years knowing my way around Windows. So from a desktop point of view, I run Windows.
Right.
On servers, I use Apache and PHP, and I do some PHP development for web servers, partly for paying clients and partly for my own good.
Sure.
and my own purposes. So Unix on the server side and Windows on the desktop.
Right, okay. That's interesting. It does seem like that throughout the board, really.
It does. Yeah. I'm not, you know, I've never really used a Unix GUI. I'm command line, telnet, FTP type access to Unix machines, and that does me on the server side. But when we're talking about graphical sides of things, and desktop applications, then I tend to use the Windows ones because that's what I'm used to, and I've spent 20 years learning how to do it.
Sure.
And one of the things I hate, one of the things that hackers generally hate, is frustration at wanting to do something and having it in their mind what they want to do and not knowing how to do it.
And
because I know how to use Windows, I stick with it. I do occasionally try the Mac, and I do occasionally load up various versions of Linux, and I get frustrated fairly quickly, so I give up trying. I should probably try and teach myself a bit more, but I don't have the time. There's too many things to keep on top of nowadays.
Yeah, it's very true.
You know, trying to learn three different operating systems and actually do a job at the same time is very difficult.
Yeah. I do agree with you there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's not going to get any better because technology is continually changing. There's all these companies bringing out new things, upgrades to existing things. You know, a couple of years ago, we didn't have things like VoIP and Skype and stuff. Just get more things to get on top of, and it's just far too difficult to get on top of all of them.
You have to really find your specialization within the sector and kind of
absolutely. And because one of the things I do is I talk to companies and advise them about security. Most companies nowadays use Windows on desktops, so that's the one I concentrate on. If that changes, then obviously I will have to change the way I work and change the research I do.
Sure.
But most companies at the moment are using Windows on desktops. Having said that, there are quite a few companies who, mostly for cost reasons, are looking at switching. And one interesting point, of course, is that the computing world is very much going thin client nowadays.
I know people who
sit in front of computers all day, and the only program they ever use is the web browser because everything is done over the internet.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, it doesn't really matter what desktop you use. You could use a kiosk thing. You can use a dedicated browser.
Yeah.
You can use Linux. It doesn't matter. All you want is a web browser. And once that starts happening, once we find Office applications server-based and HTML-based and JavaScript and Java and Ajax and PHP and all that, there will be no need for desktop as we know it. Certainly there won't be any need for as powerful a desktop machine as we currently know it. And I think that, if anything, is what's going to spell the end for Windows because it's simply unnecessary.
Yeah, yeah.
The applications will be on the server, and all you want on the desktop is 4 meg of RAM and a web browser, and that'll be great. the support people will love that because there's no work to do on desktop machines.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, no annual upgrades, no having to chuck machines in skips every 3 years and replace them with more powerful machines.
So it's going to be undoing the whole Microsoft adding on the functionality layers every release.
I think Microsoft is going to have to change. Yeah. I don't think Microsoft will die. They will move into other areas, or hopefully they will anticipate the way things are going, and they will give people what they need and what they want. But at the moment, if you look at the huge amount of processing power you need to run Windows and Office in the average company,
compared to Linux.
Yeah.
It is astonishing. Sorry, go ahead.
Certainly Windows Vista is going to be pushing up the requirements even further.
Absolutely, and you know, it's going. Although Windows Vista will run on existing PCs, I've got the beta running on, you know, a 3 or 4 year old PC here, and it's okay. It's going to really come into its own when you've got much more modern hardware that's designed for Windows Vista, and you know, you're going to end up with the average desktop PC being about the same spec as the average corporate network server, and that's just mad, if you ask me. It's a waste of resources, it's a waste of money, and you really don't need it. And the people who have to support it just have huge amounts of problems.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, certainly, I would agree that when you get into a situation when you have to have a super high-end box just to run the operating system, then we're in the realm of madness.
Yeah.
I mean, it's from our point of view as sort of hackery type people, it's great fun and it's nice to have such a powerful box to play with. But from the point of view of a secretary in a company who wants to write the occasional letter, why does that person need a machine that's as powerful as a network server just to write a letter and print it? When actually it can be done via a web browser, the information saved on the server, which is the way that most companies work nowadays anyway, because they have everything saved on file servers. So you can see the world going thin client nowadays. Lots and lots of software development nowadays inside companies is being done over web browsers rather than on desktop PCs. No client software to roll out, no client software to upgrade every time it changes. Brilliant idea. And of course, that will change the way hackers work, because web hacking will then become even more important to the hackers, because there is so much more information on those servers that they can get hold of if they know how to break in. And companies are going to have to learn how to write secure web applications. And you've only got to look at all the website defacements, all the SQL injections that take place to realize that companies currently don't know how to write secure web applications, and hopefully that will change.
It is a definite push for the thin client, and it's going to be much more cost effective when a business doesn't have to buy 50 hyper threaded Intel machines that cost £500 each. They could just purchase a very simple thin client keyboard, mouse, and monitor, and everything is piped through as network speeds increase to the gigabit now. That's this kind of standard that we're seeing right now in the industry. You can quite effectively do everything, as you said, from a web browser.
Absolutely. I've got PCs at home that are 3 or 4 years old, and they work just fine because I don't have particularly high requirements. Most of the time, I either write text, which doesn't need any huge processing power at all, or I'm connected to a web browser or to a web server where I can just upload PHP scripts. I'm not doing huge amounts of development on my local PCs.
Sure.
But that sort of practice doesn't make money for Microsoft and doesn't make money for Intel, so they've got to continually pump out faster and faster processors and persuade us to upgrade. And some things, yes, you're going to want to have the fastest power, mostly the graphics market and the games market, and perhaps some of the larger applications, and also things like personal video recorders, and the way that the computer is now becoming, the hub of the home in terms of TV and music. But for the desktop PC in a company that's used for standard, Office applications, Word, Excel, PowerPoint, and so on, thin client will do, and it will be great if that became more of the norm, and if we didn't have to have dual-core processors and a couple of gigabytes of RAM and a 250 gig hard disk on the standard desktop PC. It's just unnecessary.
Right. So, moving away from from computer misuse to DRM, digital rights management. How do you see the whole move for digital rights management on every single DVD, every single MP3 should be encoded in specialized DRM? Do you see that as a breakdown in the freedom of information flow, or do you see that as a good thing for a company or a corporation?
I see it as a breakdown, and more importantly, the market sees it as a breakdown. Companies have tried it recently with these protected CDs that simply installed rootkits on various people's computers, and that's involved in, you know, results in huge amounts of bad publicity. you then see companies like Napster who go and relaunch themselves, and they set up DRM, which is so strict that once you you subscribe to Napster and you can download your music as much as you like, once you stop paying your monthly fee, all the music you've downloaded is no longer available to you. And you can see why users are just saying, well, we're not going to have this. We'll go back to the illegal systems, which they are doing, although legitimate systems like iTunes are doing horrendously well. There needs to be some sort of compromise. The music industry has always been very greedy. They are still charging a dollar or so for a track for downloading, even when the actual costs of providing that are minute compared with pressing CDs, designing covers, shipping CDs around the world. You know, they're not passing on their savings.
Sure.
And hopefully some sort of compromise will be found. Reminds me a bit of the early days when the Pentium processor first came in. Every Pentium processor had a unique serial number.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was going to be a way that software developers could use this for copy protection, and the market simply said, absolutely no way, we're not buying Pentium processors if somebody can track my usage and tie it down to a unique serial number. So Intel disabled it, and that's the way it's going with DRM. You know, companies are realizing that they're just overstepping the mark, and the market won't have it, and they're having to take it off again. And some, again, as is the case with the Computer Misuse Act, a compromise is going to have to be reached, and companies will keep trying to move further and further ahead. The market will keep saying no and making them fall back, and at some point we'll reach a situation where we're all happy with. And I don't think we're there yet, and I don't quite know what the situation is going to be, but no one's happy yet, but they will be eventually. But I don't like the way it's going, the fact that you can be tracked, the fact that people know very much about what music you're downloading, website cookies and stuff are tracking what you do. Even if you go and use London Underground and you use one of these prepay Oyster cards, then there's a database of which card has been to which stations and who's made what journeys, and the police can monitor that and find out who's been going where. And, you know, that sort of invasion of privacy is not going to go away. It's certainly going to get worse when ID cards come in. You know, don't get me started on that.
Well,
DRM is going to be a big problem, and it will be here for some time to come, but hopefully some sort of compromise will be reached.
Yeah. That was actually my next section of the question was, how do you see, you basically said don't get me started on it, but I'd love to pick your brains about the whole all-in-one ID card, RFID, and the privacy sector. So if you obviously they say that the Oyster cards are fully secure, but we're seeing things from the underground coming up saying, hey, they work in this way, they work in that way. It's possible to sit down, in theory, with this new fancy all-in-one ID card that will include some form of RFID, to sit down next door to somebody on a bus and basically take all their personal information off them. Obviously, this might be slightly exaggerated as in theorized, but that is actually what can happen with Oyster cards at the moment. How do you see this whole thing moving forward? Do you think it's going to be a very Orwellian, United Kingdom or not?
What annoys me most about ID cards is, firstly, if you speak to the politicians and say, how exactly are ID cards going to prevent terrorism? And how are they going to prevent more bomb attacks? And no one's got an answer. I don't quite, it's very handy that we have attacks like the July attacks in London, like the World Trade Center attacks in the US, because politicians who want to start introducing things like ID cards have got the perfect excuse to go to the public and say, look, we've got to do something about it, let's introduce ID cards. But when you sit down and think about it, how on earth is that going to prevent bombs? Yes, you might find out who the people on the bus who blew themselves up were, but that's not going to stop them planting the thing in the first place.
Yeah.
Secondly, we already have the infrastructure for ID cards in at least two different ways in the UK. We have passports and we have driving licences,
sure.
Either of which could act as the ID card.
Sure.
All you need to do, I mean, most people nowadays have a driving licence. Those that don't have one because they don't drive.
Yeah.
So all you have to do is introduce a new category of driver, because you already have four or five different categories. You have HGV, lorry drivers, you have car drivers, you have bike riders. Introduce another category called no vehicle at all. And then simply say that everyone by law has to have a driving license.
Yeah.
And if you don't have a car, then you simply tick the category that says, I haven't got a vehicle. Done. Costs, you know, say £5-10 million,
mm.
and you've got yourself an ID card system.
Yeah.
Equally with a passport. You know, everyone's got a passport. So again, for the cost of a few million pounds, you've got yourself an ID system. But no, we have to have yet another one, which is going to cost, what, £5 billion? I just can't believe that the government is falling for the marketing tactics of the big IT suppliers, saying that it's going to cost £5 billion. You don't need to do it that way. And that's before we even get on to the privacy aspects of the way it's going to work. My understanding of the way ID cards are going to work is that we already have lots of information about us. As you know, Oyster cards track where you've been, RFID cards track what you buy from the supermarket, as do credit cards. Number plate recognition tracks where your car's been and so on. What the police lack is a way of tying all that information together. There needs to be a unique reference number that ties your car number plate to your personal, yourself, to your address, to where you work and everything, so they can say, this person who made this journey is the same person who went on in this car, on this train, works at this place, and one unique, you know, key field in the database, if you like, and that's where the ID card will come in. It ties all the information together. It ties up all the intelligence into one place. And once the law enforcement people have that, that will be a huge benefit to them, and yet another erosion of liberties and privacy in this country, whatever little liberties and privacy we have. And now you can see why I said, don't get me started.
Well, no, I'm glad we did, because obviously, you know, the more we know about other people's points of views, the more we can understand about the true actual feelings towards these things, because obviously the media love to inject their own point of view, and obviously their point of view means that everybody else has the same point of view, which isn't true at all, because many people either don't care or are strongly against it, or, you know, fall in between the point of, well, I might as well because everybody else will. So yeah, it's
a lot of people also.
Sorry?
A lot of people still go with the idea that if you're not up to anything, then what have you got to hide, and so what have you got to fear?
Sure.
But we've seen many, many cases where that argument just doesn't hold up.
That's the problem. I mean, the arguments don't hold up. It's a big problem with ID cards. You know, if somebody said to me, ID card's a good idea, they will stop terrorism, they will reduce crime, and here's how, then I'll listen to them. But no one has actually said that. Everyone has just said, we have to have ID cards, it will reduce crime.
Mm.
If somebody will tell me why, then I may or may not agree with them, at least I can form an argument and
sure.
form an opinion. But the politicians won't tell us that, because they don't know, presumably.
Exactly. We are...
We've seen cases... Sorry. We've seen cases, many cases in the news and different media, where people have been wrongly arrested just because they've been placed in certain locations where things have happened, and they've fitted a profile.
Absolutely. And once we start having more automatic systems around at railway stations that claim to be able to recognise, you know, the body language of a terrorist, that sort of situation is going to get worse. And I'm not saying we shouldn't have systems and that we shouldn't do everything we can in order to make sure the country stays safe, because obviously that's of the utmost importance. But you've only got to look at what happened to that poor Brazilian guy being shot on the tube to see that things can go wrong.
Exactly.
And it's interesting that there was a report out, I think yesterday, about the fact that the reason MI5 failed to protect the London bombing attacks was because they were under-resourced, and what would have fixed it would be more money, which is interesting because, in my opinion, you certainly can't buy hindsight. They like to think you can.
Yeah.
And maybe this whole thing is just a cynical exercise to get even more funding for the organisation.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, they obviously did something wrong, and what they're saying is we want more money to continue doing the same thing, but even more of it, which is not what they want to do. They need to change the way they work. They don't need to carry on doing what they do and do even more of it, because that's clearly where they failed. The US has a very similar situation whereby whenever it's coming up for budget renewal time for the NSA and the CIA, they put out these press releases saying the country is in mortal danger, we need more money, that's the only solution. It looks like it's happening in the UK now as well, as any management consultant will tell you. It's not always a case of just throwing more money at things. You've got to spend the money wisely and analyse what you're doing and where you're going wrong, and it's not always the case that more money is what you need.
Very, very true. I think you share the same views as everybody else on the radio show. So, it does seem that every kind of government involvement project, mainly IT sector, the more it goes wrong, the more money they throw at it.
Yeah, because one of the best ways for an IT company to make money is to sell information or hardware or software or consultancy to the government, because they will basically, just from what I understand, pay whatever you charge for it. And there's just people out there trying to make money, not necessarily providing the best system at the best price. And it's us, the taxpayers, who are paying the price of that. And it's a very sad situation. We end up with what isn't the best system, but it's what the government sold, and they didn't really have the skills to be able to say, actually, this is not what we need.
Sure.
We can do it much better. We can do it much cheaper. If they were a private company, that's what they'd be obliged to do. But it would appear that government isn't.
Sure. I hate to say this, we are actually running out of time. So go ahead.
Oh, okay. It's in regards to the technology of surveillance and ID cards and such, whereby at the moment a lot of security is carried out by security-savvy people who are trained to watch for certain things happening and for certain shady types of individuals that are doing types of things. Would you agree that possibly, if we're forced to rely on these biometric ID cards and the super robot system that watches people for dodgy behaviour and things that smell your clothes as you walk through the door and what have you, do you think that will actually reduce security?
I think it will reduce security. I think it will certainly...
Rather than relying on a pretty smart security guard that's keeping an eye on someone who's actually a bit dodgy...
I'm assuming that what the technology will do, or what it's designed to do, is to provide a sort of first-level filter. And, ideally, it would do that... highlight all the people that should then be watched more closely or brought in for questioning or whatever, and if that's the way it works, then that's fine. I'm prepared to accept that. I certainly won't be happy if the police, for example, make, life and death decisions purely on the basis of what a computer screen says. I'd like them to have a human intervention, and ideally they will always have that, but sometimes, they've got seconds to act, and someone's got to make that decision, is this person worth shooting or not? And I'd never like to be the person who has to make that decision,
sure.
Because as we've tragically seen, it does sometimes go wrong.
Exactly.
Technology is wonderful. It's brought some major advances in the last few years. If there was ever a time when it's going to start going wrong and causing problems and going bad, as it were, maybe this is it, and we should all be worried.
And sadly, on that note,
at the moment,
so I've got to close the show off because we're running very quickly out of time.
That makes sense.
I'd love to welcome you back on another show whenever you're free, because I'm sure. You know, we could go on talking about this forever.
Always
We're really restricted to an hour because we're syndicated with other radio stations. But it was a pleasure to talk to you. It's been such an eye opener actually to speak to you. I'm sure Dark Nature shares the same views.
Absolutely, it was a privilege to speak to you.
Lovely to speak to you both. Thanks for having me on.
No problems, and I hope we can hear from you again sometime.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Well, I hope you have a good evening, and
thank you.
We'll keep in touch.
Indeed.
Take care.
Bye.
And a good weekend.
Good night. Thank you for listening. Any radio requests or, any emails to the radio show, radio@hackervoice.co.uk. Thank you for listening to Hacker Voice Radio. We'll see you same time next week. Anybody with eyes, folks, love. Anybody with eyes.